Okay, welcome everyone. My name is Ellie Confer. I'm excited to be teaching tonight at this three-way combination program, four-way combination program of the first time I'm teaching all of the full-time fellows since September. So welcoming the winter week of learning college folks. Woo. And all the folks who are here for the Taste of Yeshivat Adar, interested in applying, or just know someone who's interested in applying and you will transmit this to them, or our folks who are presumably watching this on some internet address. Even though I can't see if this is working, it might be. Okay. So we're going to talk about the Cairo Geniza tonight and the influence specifically that the Cairo Geniza has on our understanding of liturgy. So just a little bit of story time about the Cairo Geniza before we actually spend what we're going to be doing for most of the evening, which is looking at an alternate version of a liturgy that most of us have encountered in some form or another, which is the text of the Amida, the text of the daily Amida that is said at every... these portions of it are said at every Jewish service. So we are past the 100-year anniversary of the discovery of the Cairo Geniza. The Cairo Geniza was... the discovery is usually attributed to... Who's our... Salomon Schechter.
Two ladies.
That guy was all over the place. He's founding schools. He's, you know the whole story is everybody thinks he's a donor. So Salomon Schechter was credited with discovering the Cairo Geniza. In fact, the Geniza was known to scholars before Schechter discovered it, but it had never really been plumbed to its depths. And the reason that Schechter, who was one of the leading Judaic scholars at the time, he was a scholar at Cambridge University in England, the reason that he focused on it was because two women who were Scottish tourists in Egypt in the late 1890s, mid-1890s, ended up going to the synagogue, the Ben Ezra Synagogue in Cairo, which I will, this is prop number one, which one of our alums, Morty Walfish, went to just recently, like in the last few months, where you can get this tourist pamphlet here, which has a lot of detail about other synagogues in Egypt. But anyways, this is the picture. We can pass it around. But those women went there and were sort of... amateur collectors. So they bought a manuscript from a dealer there who had access to the Cairo Geniza. And they took it to Salomon Schechter in Cambridge to have him evaluate it. And what he noticed was that of the, you have to understand, there were about 200,000 manuscript pages that were in the Cairo Geniza eventually when they emptied it out. And these women sort of struck gold because the page that they brought to Schechter was the Hebrew version of a section of a book called Ben Sira, which is a it's definitely a psh kind of book. It's one of those amazing, didn't make it into the Bible, but sort of gets quoted sometimes books. And it was only known in translation. But what these women found by accident was that the original Hebrew, which had survived in the Cairo Geniza. This book was written in the 2nd century BCE and had made its way down into this collection of manuscripts. And therefore, Schechter knew, Schechter, who could understand what this was and the importance of it, said, we have to figure out what's going on here. And he basically devoted most of the rest of his academic focus to trying to figure out what all the treasures are in this Geniza. So he went to Cairo, and he brought back as many manuscripts as he could handle, shipping out to Cambridge, and a lot of them did end up in Cambridge University in England. Eventually, they got scattered across the libraries of Europe, and a number of them are here at JTS as well, in New York, some at YU, and I'll just, at the end of the shiur, we'll talk a little bit about the what happened to those manuscripts, because if you do the math, this is in the late 1890s when this all happens. Putting things in libraries in Europe and Jews is a bad mix. A few years later, so we'll get back to what happened to these manuscripts at the end. But we're going to look, as I said, at this text tonight, the text of the Amida in the Geniza. And I should say, if you can hand these out, thank you. The one of the greatest contributions of the Geniza was actually to liturgy, because what people put in a Geniza is often those used prayer books that they're not using anymore. And the interesting thing about the Cairo Geniza as a location is that it reflected a Jewish community that up until about the 10th century represented two approaches to Jewish community. You had a tradition from local Egypt, and then you had a tradition from Eretz Yisrael, obviously the neighboring country, and they were sort of your neighboring synagogues, your warring synagogues. So all of the stuff that both of these very different liturgically based communities had ended up getting thrown into the Cairo Geniza. So we're going to look at some of that stuff that was discovered. But just to start off, part of the thing that the Geniza opened up was the possibility that liturgy is not as uniform as we think it is. And the reason that we think it's so uniform actually comes from a halakha in the Tosefta, this first halakha on page 1 of the source sheet. So we're offline. Okay, if someone just wants to read box 1, we can, for ease of time and speed, we'll just read it in the English. The Hebrew is there. Box 1, go ahead, Maya, take it from me.
Rabbi Yossi said, whoever alters the form that the sages formed for a brachot has not fulfilled his obligation for prayer.
Okay, so anybody who mishanem arpeya shetavu chachamim bibracha, anybody who changes the format of the bracha is lo yatsa, does not fulfill the obligation for prayer. Now, this idea of not changing things about a particular part of the liturgy, the blessing formula, gets even stronger, brought by a fellow named Pirkoi ben Baboy. Top 5 names in Jewish history, who says the following thing in text number 2. We'll talk about who he's in 1 second, but who can just read text number 2. John, go ahead, please.
Sure. Any blessing not said in the Talmud, one is forbidden from blessing it, and is forbidden to add one letter.
V'asur lo'siv od achat. So taking this idea of, okay, what's a matbea? Maybe I can change the words but not change the theme. Maybe that's allowed. Pirkoi ben Baboy says, if you add one letter, you're out, right? You're not allowed to change even one letter of the blessing. Now, the irony is that Pirkoi ben Baboy was one of the chief students of Rav Yudai Gaon, who was one of the top Gaonim, the people who were sort of in charge of the scholarly Jewish community following the Talmudic era. He lived around the year 800. And his writings were completely unknown until the discovery of the Cairo Geniza. So you have this ironic situation where the fellow whose opinion is you should not change even one letter of a bracha was discovered by dint of the Cairo Geniza. Unfortunately, hundreds of and thousands of manuscripts that violated his principle were discovered at the same time. So such is the vagaries of history. But you can see that this idea of you can't change anything in tefillah at all went to its extreme by the Gaonim, who were sort of credited with standardizing Jewish liturgy. But if you notice, like those of us who were at the Bris this morning and picked up the Sephardic Siddur at the Spanish and Portuguese synagogue, there are letters that change in Jewish liturgy, even if you just go to your next door shul that's not your local shul. And that's what the next source is about. So could someone just read the Budraham? Yeah, please.
There are those people who count the number of words in every blessing from the Amidah, and they bring verses on every blessing with the same number of words as that blessing. I used to do this counting myself. But then I realized that there is no foundation for this and no root for it, because you won't find a place in the world that has the same number of words in the Amidah. Rather, some add words and some remove words, and therefore the counting is only useful for one particular person and not another.
Okay, so Abudraham, who is one of the classic commentators on the Siddurs, living in Spain in the 14th century, he said, I had this practice of counting letters and words in tefillah. And this is something that was really popularized by the German mystics who were living a couple centuries before him. The idea that what you say in the prayer book is less important from a meaning standpoint and more important from a sort of magical counting standpoint. The numbers of letters is what's significant. And he said, I used to do this, and it's, you know, it's very significant. You have whatever it is, 42 letters in this bracha, is the 42-letter name of God, as that's significant. Or you play some gematria games of, you know, this equals that. But then I noticed, I went next door, and I picked up their sitter, and they have an extra letter or word or whole different formulation, and the whole thing falls apart. So I gave up that practice, said Abu Draham, right? So you have this sense that, on the one hand, the idea that brachot always stay the same, and even to the point of we can't even change one letter, right? You change even one letter, you're in violation. And then, you know, on the other hand, Abu Draham, who was not a Reconstructionist, who went and said, basically, I know there's some variety in liturgy, you know, you can't fool me. So what we're going to look at a little bit tonight is the way in which the Geniza really blew apart the idea that there was uniformity in liturgy, even far beyond the imagination of the Abu Draham himself. And we'll see how that played out in our text of the Amidah. So what I'm going to ask you to do in Chavruta is turn over to page 3 in the source sheet. And what I brought for you here from page 3 to page 7 is two versions of the Amidah. On the right-hand side, you have the traditional Ashkenazi, contemporary Amidah that those who daven in Ashkenazi communities say on every weekday Amidah. And on the left-hand side, you have one version of a complete manuscript of the Amidah that was discovered in the Cairo Geniza that represents a different form of liturgy entirely, the liturgy of Eretz Yisrael, the liturgy of the land of Israel. And what I did is I juxtaposed them. On page 3, I translated them. Moving forward from 4 through 7, I didn't end up translating them. But if you're comfortable working in the English, you can hang out on page 3, and you'll be fine. There'll be plenty of stuff for you to focus on there. If you want to work in the Hebrew, you want to move on, and you can skip around for all I care, you can look at the various different brachot. That option is available to you. And I guess I want you to focus on two questions. The first question is, what are the differences that you notice? What's surprising about those differences? What are the surprising differences that you notice between these two texts? And number two, if you can construct it, and this is an open-ended question which I don't have an answer to, is there some thematic overall difference between the Eretz Yisrael version and the modern contemporary Ashkenazi version that you could identify? So number one, on a local level, what's surprising about the differences? And number two, on a global level, what's the thematic difference of the liturgy of Eretz Yisrael versus the liturgy that we have? So what I'm going to ask that you do is, for people who are here live, for folks at home, you're on your own for the next few minutes, but for all of us, I'm going to offer you to learn with someone new, and I would recommend that for those of the folks who are here in the college program to seek someone out who's here in the full-year fellows program. Just do a little bit of mixing and matching for this chavruta, and I invite you to do that now. So you can stand up and move around as that suits you.